The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
Why did Riley go to Vietnam?
I'll tell you why she didn't go. She didn't go to actually find her brother. I think she just felt that, A, she needed to get out of San Francisco, and B, I think she just wanted to see the last place that he had been. Some sort of, you know, closure, although I doubt that Riley would believe in such a concept as closure. And I guess same reason that I went to Vietnam is because it seemed like a good idea at the time. One of my favorite Jim Harrison quotes is, "Everything is a good idea at the time."
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Marian Palaya about her debut novel, The Given World.
You didn't write this novel from the beginning to the end. Tell us how it happened.
I wrote the first of the chapters as a standalone short story, and it is the chapter that's called Girl Three Speeds Pretty Good Brakes, a long time ago. I wrote it probably in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s. I can't remember exactly. And sent it off, and it got published in Passages North a long time ago. And it was just, that was all it was ever meant to be, was just this story about this girl in a gas station and with the missing brother. And then when I went to Madison in 2010 to get my MFA, I was working with Lori Moore, which was awesome. And she gave us an assignment to write, because her son had just gotten this assignment to do an essay on what it is or what it means to be an American. So the first night of class, she said, okay, I want you guys to go home and write, you know, a story on what it means to be an American. And I wrote the beginning of the Vietnam chapter for that assignment. And it was really just this woman in Saigon who meets a barmaid who's pregnant. And it kind of had a happy ending. It had a soft landing. And Lori promptly advised me to see what would happen if we didn't give it a soft landing. And it really opened up an incredible world for me of hard landings, you know what I mean? Because by that time I was old enough to write hard things, and that was pretty much what Lori said, is, you know, it's time for you to write things that hurt. So I did, and then the rest of the book, well, most of the rest of it I wrote as short stories for the MFA, and then went back over the next couple of years and aligned it as a novel, which was a lot harder than it sounds.
Might have been easier just to start out writing a
novel.
Yeah,
but I didn't know how to write. You know, I didn't know. I was terrified of writing a novel because it seemed like such a huge undertaking, and that you had to know what you were doing. And I've realized since that you don't. You get to just keep writing and things keep happening. So the one I'm working on now is coming out more along the lines of a novel, but it's still all over the place. I guess it's just the nature of the beast.
One San Francisco reviewer wrote, "Much of this deeply felt work reverberates with the tones of a modern Western, and that it also qualifies as a picaresque, a story in which a rogue hero travels through a series of episodic adventures." Did you intend to write a modern picaresque Western?
No. I didn't even know what that is. No, a lot of the chapters were written about people that I actually knew or know, mostly knew, because most of them have died in the interim of, you know, just bad living. And that's not something I think I'll ever be able to do again, but it was really a gift to be able to do it for this book. You know, to have those people fit into this narrative was pretty cool. And and whether they fit or not is, I suppose, up to the reviewers, although most of them have been pretty kind about all these wayward creatures, you know, filling up the novel. But no, I mean, I never had any idea of sort of the shape of it or the structure of it as being a picaresque or any other thing. It was just a story, and it was just the people, the kinds of people that were in San Francisco in those years, or the kinds of people that I knew in San Francisco in those years. They were some pretty crazy times. I mean, it was a whole generational thing, and how much of it had to do directly with Vietnam, who knows? You know, that's one of the things about this book. I think that the expectation is that it's going to be a book about Vietnam, and that it ends up being about completely different things. And I think it puzzles people at first, and I think some people are disappointed, but it's mostly about the generation after the war.
Well, I liked that reviewer's description, because I didn't think of that when I was reading the book. Mm-hmm. I was just into the story. But it makes sense in a way, because Riley does go off on these episodic adventures in one way or another. This is not normal everyday life for most people.
No.
And she comes from the West, and she has a life in Montana, in rural Montana, that a lot of people in that time and at that age had. So I felt like this might be a new way to look at the Western, because, you know, she's a singular, solitary, mm-hmm. independent person,
right,
in some ways, trying to find her way.
Yeah. It's funny, because when I started my creative writing career here in 1982, I think, I started in the journalism department.
At the University of Montana.
Here, as mm-hmm. an undergrad, I was married to a guy out in Drummond, and I had been going to school in Olympia, Washington at Evergreen, and then I ended up falling in love with this guy and marrying him. And so I was in school here, and I had always known that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't really know what that meant. And I thought if you wanted to write, you had to write journalism. That was the only thing I knew. So I signed up for this, you know, the basic journalism 101 or whatever. And the professor was wonderful. I remember his name was Bob, and I think he's still around. And I did one semester with him, and I was living in Drummond, so I couldn't cover the stories that they wanted us, you know, the city council meetings and stuff. And so I would just make things up, like the Drummond Loggers Wives Association meeting, you know, and of course, and it would, you know, break out in a brawl, and, you know, and so I would turn in these crazy stories, and he would say, you made this up, right? And I, no, this was true. And then at the end of the semester, I confessed that I had made up, like, everything I'd written for the whole semester except for one story about this guy I knew. Anyway, and he said, you know, you can write, but you're in the wrong department, because you can't just make stuff up as a journalist. Although I know some do, but, and he actually took me, I mean, he walked me, the way I remember it was a long time ago, but he walked me over to the Liberal Arts Building and introduced me to Dick Hugo and said, this is the creative writing department. And he said, hey, Hugo, I've got a live one for you. And I was like, what? What? You can actually study this stuff? Like, this is magic. And it really was a great experience. And I still remember stories that my classmates wrote for those workshops. I mean, some of the best writing and all my experiences I remember came out of those undergrad workshops. With Barry Hanna was here that year, crazy. Insane. Ford was around. Richard Ford was around. Kittredge was still here. Jim Welch was still here. It was really pretty nutty times, but it was magic. And my work then was referred to in the department as punk westerns. and that's always sort of stayed with me. So when that review came out in the Chronicle and I saw that, I was like, yeah, this the punk western thing.
Well, back to your book. Riley adores and worships her older brother,
yes,
Mick, which is why it was so hard for her when he disappeared during the Vietnam War. And there's a passage near the beginning of the book that shows their relationship when she's 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind reading that?
I don't mind. I like to read. President Johnson in the paper said Vietnam was a different kind of war. I knew I could ask Mick about that, about how many kinds of war there were, or how there could even be different kinds, but he was outside. My parents were out there too, Mom probably in the garden already, digging up potatoes before the sun got so high and hot it would turn them green, and Dad fixing fences or tractoring or scaring up dopey runaway calves, the usual, our life. I collected the bowl of apples and the peeler Mom had left on the counter for me and went out to the front porch. I balanced the bowl on the railing and slid my feet between two spindles to get up to stand on the bottom rail so I could lean over and get a better look at my brother. Mick was crouched in the driveway next to a black Triumph motorcycle, his high school graduation present to himself. He was hoping to catch a girl with it, I knew, or to go away on it, or both. I was not in favor of either, but he was over the moon. The bike was magnificent. His toolbox lay open in the dust, and a greasy rag dangled like a cockeyed tail from the back pocket of his coveralls. Most of his blonde hair was tucked up under a train engineer's cap, but a few wayward strands crept down his neck and caught the poplar-filtered morning light like filaments of some shiny spun metal. No one else in the family had hair like that, not even close. I thought about sneaking up behind him with a pair of scissors and snipping off a piece, but it seemed like a lot of work and probably not worth the repercussions. Instead, I looked around for something small to throw at him, as it was my habit to be annoying. I did know better than to hit him with an entire apple. Without looking at me, he said, "Don't even think about it," and gave one of the screws on the engine an infinitesimal turn. "I wasn't thinking about anything," I said. I was still searching, but there was nothing. I'm sure I sighed. I was a great sigher in those days. I picked up the bowl and sat down with my back to the wall, scissored my legs open, and set the bowl between them. The peeler was still on the porch railing. Crap. "What's wrong? Can't find a weapon?" "I left the peeler. It's on the rail." "Bummer. Get it for me?" "Nope." "Thanks. My pleasure, cupcake." I didn't move. I sniffed the air, and it smelled like cow farts. I said so. Mick said, "What smells like cow farts?" "The world." "Probably not," he said. "Probably just Montana." "Oh." I pondered my entire range of geographic and zoologic knowledge, not coming up with a whole lot. "So does that mean Africa smells like hippo farts?" "I doubt it. Hippos fart underwater." "So what other animals are there? Anywhere or just in Africa?" "There, in Africa." "You have an encyclopedia, Riley. Why don't you look it up?" "I have to peel these." I took an apple out of the bowl and balanced it on the top of my head. "Plus, it wouldn't hurt you to just tell me." I heard him sigh. I think he must have taught me how. "All right, then will you be quiet?" "No promises." I made a noise like, "Hmm." He pulled the rag out of his pocket, dipped it in a tin of rubbing compound, and began to buff a tiny scratch on the gas tank. "Elephants. Don't even tell me if you didn't know that already. Antelope, zebras, giraffes, wildebeests, warthogs." "Warthogs?" I sat up straighter. "You made that up." "No," he said, "I did not." I tilted my head forward to drop the apple into my hand, put it back in the bowl, and slitted my eyes like a snake. I considered my options. My tendency to doubt was well earned, but I still believed most of what Mick said unless the bullshit was totally obvious. He was ridiculously smart. He read tons of books and remembered what was in them. Not like some people. "What do they look like?" I said, still not sure which way this was going to go. "Like bristly little pigs. Their tails stand straight up." I was eyeing the peeler and even went so far as to set the bowl down next to me so I could get up to retrieve it. "What else?" Mick said, "I'll draw you a picture later." "When later?" "After now." We were almost done. I could tell. "Where do these guys live?" "At the beach." "The ocean?" To me, the ocean was the most magical place in the world, even though I'd never seen one, never been farther outside Montana than the North Dakota Badlands. But even the Badlands had once been underwater, or so I'd been told. "Yes, at the beach, at the ocean, where beaches are." Mick popped off the spark plug wire, reached into his toolbox for the ratchet, and loosened the plug. The noise the ratchet made was a bit cricket-like. I wondered if I could tie that in somehow to make the conversation go further. Gave up. Mick looked over his shoulder at me. I wasn't moving. I could have been dead. "Are you going to peel those apples or what?" "What?" I said, but that was it. I knew it was going to be.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Marianne Pelaya read from her debut novel, The Given World. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. You can hear this program again as a podcast or at our blog. mtpr.org/twq is the place to find both of those. There's also a link to audio on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about why Riley can't let herself fall in love and why finding a title for the book was such a challenge. Stay with us.
So years later, Mick goes to Vietnam. He's drafted into the Vietnam War, and then he disappears just a couple of months before he's supposed to come home, which just devastates Riley. Tell what she does when she finally decides she's going to go see the ocean for herself.
Well, first she discovers mescaline, basically, which just takes her out of herself, and she spends a lot of time sort of lying out in the wheat fields, high, and meets a boy and leaves him and goes to Missoula and gets a job working in a gas station, which was the original, the nugget that this whole thing was built around. And she spends just maybe one year in Missoula, and then just decides to go, and she's got this beater 67 Mustang, and she just wants to see the ocean. And I think she just feels really trapped at that point by everything and by Montana. So she drives. She just leaves one afternoon and drives down through Nevada and over the Sierras and ends up on the coast of California, somewhere what I always pictured would be right around Big Sur or somewhere, and it's foggy, and she's sitting there in her car because she's come all this way, and she can't actually see the ocean because of the fog. The fog is so thick, but she can hear it and smell it, and so she just sits there. She gets back in her car and falls asleep, and when she wakes up, the fog is gone, and she sees the ocean. And it sucks her in, and she stays. She doesn't know where she's going to go, but the next chapter opens, and she has made her way to San Francisco, which is where all the girls went in the 1970s when they wanted to escape Iowa or Nebraska or Montana or wherever.
At one point in the novel, Riley thinks, "Love is something I do not obviously know how to do, but some recalcitrant tendency keeps driving me to make the attempt over and effing over."
Yeah.
Why can't she love people, and what's driving that recalcitrant tendency?
Oh, who knows? I mean, I'm sure that a good therapist could have a field day with Riley, but, you know, I imagine it's just her fear of losing the most important person in her life. It's just has gone missing, and and she never finds out what happened to him, or she doesn't for a long, long time. And I think she's just afraid to commit to anything because life is not committable. You know, it's just too dodgy. And I think she just doesn't trust that anything good could ever come of love. And yeah, I think she just doesn't trust herself. You know, like Frank is such a great guy, and he tries so hard to get her to, you know, settle down and fall in love with him and have a nice, normal life. And there's just no way.
It was a little bit ironic that she didn't have any trouble deserting her parents.
No. I mean, I did try, because I knew that that was something that would make her look, I don't know, pretty cold. But I think they understood that she was just she was so unhappy. She was just so heartbroken and so unhappy. And they were, too. They were pretty broken, too. So I think they just saw that the best thing to do would be to just let her go. And I think she says it at one point that she's afraid that she's just a reminder to them of this other kid and that maybe they don't want to be reminded. I don't think any of them were really in their right minds after Mick went missing. And I think, you know, the mom, I think, was always a little bit unstable anyway. I mean, it's a through line in the book, but it's not a very, it's kind of a subtle one. But I always imagined Rose as being a little drifty, a little tilty anyway. And the dad, who knows?
They're interesting characters because I think they do represent a rural mindset mm-hmm. at that time in the 60s and 70s. You're supposed to take care of yourself and be independent and not have to look to anyone else for help.
Right. Yeah.
The phrase, the given world, is part of a poem which is presented at the beginning of the book. Why did you choose those three words out of that poem for the title?
My agent and I searched for a title for this book for a long time because she really wanted to find something that wasn't too dark. I mean, when Emma read it, she saw hopefulness in it. The titles I was picking, I can't really remember what they were, but they were all pretty dark. And she said, no, there is hopefulness in this book, and I want that to reflect. So I started looking at poems about the war, and then I just, you know, you get into those poetry sites, and you can just be in there for days, which I was. And I stumbled on this Jane Hirschfield poem and read it. And not only did The Given World really strike me as really fitting for this book, because, you know, everybody is given their own version of the world. And that's sort of what I saw that meaning, is this is the given world. This is what you got. This is what you get to do something with or have to do something with. But the poem itself, I think, just so beautifully coalesces with what is going on in the book. I mean, that image of the horses cropping the grass through the snow, and that last line of, what is that? I can never remember exactly, and I hate to mess it up because it's so beautiful. The stars ticking by one overhead, the given world flaming precisely out of its frame. I mean, that is just so amazing and beautiful.
What do you want people to take away from reading this book?
Towards the end, and I think a lot of people miss it, when she's having that conversation with Daryl about, she's thinking about war. And she says, and this is in the 90s, this is probably in the mid to late 90s, there are no absolute dates, I kind of left it loose like that, but she says to herself, I think, you know, I think by now we've had enough of war. You know, and maybe I think what she's thinking is maybe we've learned, you know, from Vietnam that it's just not a good idea, that it wrecks people, and maybe there's something else we can do to deal with things that come up. And it's very tricky I hate over-explaining, and I hope that I never do it. I don't like to be explained to, and when I'm reading, and I don't like to explain things when I'm writing. So I wanted that in there. I wanted it sort of to echo knowing what was coming up and, you know, what was going to begin in 2001, just a few years later. But, you know, that she's thinking in terms of her son, that, you know, it's that boys aren't going to be going away to war anymore. You know, we just have these standing armies, but they're not actually going to have to go and fight and kill people. And that is one of the main things that I want people to, that I want to resonate with people when they read that, is to say, you know, damn, what if that had actually been the case? And we had gone, oh no, this is, war is not really a very good idea. Let's try something different.
If we had done that at the beginning of the 2000s, yeah.
Yes, wouldn't that have changed things?
Well, I think that is a good thought to lead us into a final paragraph I'd like you to read, the beginning of chapter 11.
Yeah, this chapter is called 2 Days, Then the Bus to Cambodia. I hear that now you can fire Kalashnikov rounds for $1 a shot out at Koo Chi, and they have widened and deepened the tunnels to accommodate Western bodies. Mick had the perfect build for tunneling, and he liked dark, enclosed places. I still can't imagine, though, after the stories I've heard, how he went into those things. I have tried for years to tell myself it was lucky in some alternative configuration, that he didn't have to come home damaged and try somehow to fit in. I've known some of his compatriots here and back in the States, and not a one of them is right in the head. They're light, shy, and twitchy, still startling at certain sounds, still having the bad dreams after so much time. The suicide rate for the tunnel rats is even higher than it is for the guys who got to shoot at other people and get shot at, out in the open. Sometimes they take other folks with them when they go, innocent bystanders, as if any of us is truly that.
You've finished your MFA. You've written this debut novel. Is your life turned into what you thought it would be?
Well, nothing. No, nothing is ever what you think it's going to be. And it's changed in many ways, because now I have the wherewithal to write my second book without having to bartend or log or, you know, drive a newspaper truck or whatever, which is really a huge gift. So, but it comes with a lot of angst and frustration and guilt, you know. And I came up here this summer intending to finish a draft of my second book by the end of the summer, and I've gone from 175 pages to 62. So so, I mean, it's 62 finished pages. So it's been, yeah, it's challenging. But those 62 pages I'm very happy with. So I feel like I've made some progress, even if it's in sort of a backward direction.
You're doing a lot of the editing at the beginning of the process that you normally would do at the end.
I do. I edit as I go a lot. So it's slow.
Marian Palaya lives in San Francisco, California. Look for more information about her at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, poems and book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.